Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is host Richard Benulli. Today is February 12th, Wednesday, and we have Luke Roman and Ira Harris. Luke has 20 plus years of industry experience, earning a reputation as a client-focused analyst with an unparalleled ability to make broad connections between increasingly siloed industry news and drawing conclusions that help investors understand the bigger picture. He founded FFTT LLC in early 2014. FFTT caters to institutions and sophisticated individuals by aggregating a wide variety of macroeconomic, thematic, and sector trends in an unconventional manner to identify investable, developing economic bottlenecks for his clients. And Ira is independent trader, past hedge fund manager, and global macro consultant trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003 and a stint most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Great. I thought we'd begin, Luke, with your macro view, global macro view on the economy and financial markets.
Well, thank you. For me, the macro view breaks into two discrete periods. I think there is the next 2 to 3 months, which is murky. At best, driven by a lot of political and geopolitical uncertainty domestically and abroad. And then I think ultimately, as you get out into later in the second quarter and the back half of the year, I'm pretty bullish most broad assets. I think the dollar is going to be weakened pretty, I think it's going to be weakened as part of some sort of trade deal. And I think we will start to see more of the fruits of some of the combination of weaker dollar cost cuts in the federal government and reshoring reinvestment. And so I think we will get, I think we could see a pretty pronounced sector rotation within that. Overall, I'm bullish, but I think we'll see a sector rotation in particular out of the NASDAQ and some of the highly valued big tech names and more toward more industrial reshoring type names is how I'm thinking about the world at the moment. But like I said, for the next 2-3 months, I'm kind of just holding my chips and waiting for another card to get turned because there's a lot of moving pieces.
Mm-hmm. Quite interesting. And your thoughts? Ira, do you align with the same view?
I do. I'm trading, and I still see some things around the world that to me are interesting. But these are cautious times. You know, you don't know what's going to come flying at you to move markets. And I'm not in a position, or never want to be in a position where I'm getting run over. I want to be able to. I'm not a great reactor. But when I know that there's a lot of landmines out there, I'm not running full head. I'm going to wait to see what goes off and where we're going to go from here. Because right now there's just one thing after another. I find Luke's view on the dollar interesting because there's not a lot of people. It's a very small camp that sees a weaker dollar. But I'm in that camp. I've been in that camp. I think dollar strength is a huge drag on the global economy because so much, you know, we could talk about U.S. debt, and I'm sure we're going to get into that, but so much of foreign debt is denominated in dollars. And with the Fed on a hold course with interest rates, you know, overnight rates at, let's say, 4.37, so the cost of financing that debt, it's certainly gone way up over the last 10, 12 years. But the fact that the dollar is stronger is an added weight and really forces some countries into a very bad situation. And the Fed says they don't pay attention to it. I say nonsense. I go back to March of 2020 when they opened up the swap lines to people who never had it. So they're very aware of the impact of the strong dollar. And I think that Trump and his team are very aware of it. And I, you know, as and interestingly, Scott Bessent in his testimony, it was in an interview on Bloomberg last week, talked about, yeah, you know, he gave the proverbial nod. Yeah, we're in favor of a strong dollar. But then he talked about relative values, so counterparties, and I'm very attuned to that. And I know we'll get into some discussion of tariffs. I don't know where it'll go, but you know, not everything is tariff oriented. The overly strong dollar is a huge drag on those who Trump has said that he's going to help. So I'm with Luke in that. I hope we'll talk more about where the dollar goes from here.
Yeah. What are your thoughts, Luke, on that? Like, you've got dichotomy, it looks like, between what the Fed is looking at or wants, the Treasury Department, and the U.S. administration led by Trump. We have the tariffs that may tend to strengthen the dollar, but then maybe the target interest would be a weaker dollar for manufacturing. Well, how do you put all this together?
It's a three-body problem, or maybe a four-body problem. It's tricky because what the administration wants, there are competing interests against what they want, depending on what the dollar does, right? So they want a strong dollar relative to oil, but that's going to hurt oil production. But if they get a strong dollar, that's also going to drive foreign selling of equities, foreign selling of treasuries. That's going to send 10-year treasury yields higher. There's been a very distinct and tight relationship between the dollar and 10-year treasury yields over the last 2 to 3 years. Dollar goes up because of tariffs, because whatever reason, 10-year yields are going up. Well, Bessent came out last week and said, well, we're watching the 10-year. We want to get the 10-year down now. Well, you can have tariffs and a stronger dollar, or you can have a lower 10-year yield, but you can't have both. You're going to have one or the other based on the levels of debt that we have and the levels of foreign borrowing that I was talking about. Unless you do something that is currently outside the mainstream Overton window to devalue the debt. In other words, there's been some talk about revaluing gold, buying down debt. We can talk about that in a bit. And that is, so there's something we've been very pronounced about ever since Trump got elected, is there is an absolute order of operations that they must follow vis-a-vis tariffs, Doge, et cetera, which is if they do anything to strengthen the dollar beyond some level of too strong, and that's not too much north of here on the DXY, in my opinion, they are going to essentially politically discredit themselves early on, because they're going to crash the markets, they're going to spike the dollar, they're going to send yields up, and then they're going to look like fools, and now they're going to have 12 months and to try to fix the problem. They're going to have they'll be doing the same thing that they said they wouldn't do, and then we'll get into the midterms and they'll nothing done. So we've been saying there's very much an order of operations that must be followed and respected, which is you've got to get debt to GDP down, the dollar down in some way, shape, or form from a starting point. Too much and drive the dollar up. Anything that strengthens the dollar. And so there are some encouraging signs. We've seen Bessent last week say, I want to monetize the asset side of the balance sheet of the U.S. government for the American people. I thought was a huge hat tip to that he understands this order of operations. There's still some unclarity about what he could mean. In my opinion, it was very much a nod to will revalue gold to create a deposit in the TGA and buy myself time where I don't have to be issuing much at the long end. But that, I think, is there's these multiple problems and in turn or multiple conflicting goals. We want to get oil down, we want to get the dollar up. But if the dollar goes up, we want to get 10-year yields down. We can't get 10 years. So you've got And the link to all of those things is you can satisfy these seemingly competing or contradictory goals if you devalue the debt, if you get debt to GDP down by weakening the dollar. If you do that, you can do those things. If you do not do that first, weaken the dollar slash devalue the debt, you will be a failure. The policies they are advocating will not work, and you will create a crisis, and then you can go back to sort of crisis cleanup like it seemed like the prior 4 years was for much of the time. So that's how I'm thinking about some of those some competing interests and puts and takes.
And would the devaluation of the dollar take time in that sense for, to basically inflate away the debt? Would that not take some time, like running inflation at 4% for 10 years, reducing the debt by one half, something like that on the math?
I don't think they have time for that anymore. I think they now need to do something big and something fast. And, you know, something we've talked about for some time that is getting out in the mainstream a lot more now has been Section 2.10 of the Financial Accounting Manual for Federal Reserve Banks says that the Treasury Secretary can effectively instruct the Fed to revalue gold, and in so doing creates a deposit free and clear into the Treasury General Account. In other words, it creates M2 money based off of gold instead of off of an offsetting increase in debt. Which can then be spent into the economy, which is inflationary, which is then grows GDP relative to debt. And so I think based on where we are, we don't have the time for half measures. And why I say that is we look at, you know, what Yellen did. She's already moved debt to the short end. We look at reverse repo. It's already been heavily run down. We look at where the fiscal situation is. Quietly, last week, U.S. Treasury Borrowing Advisory Committee came out with their report, as they do quarterly, with the refunding. When you look at the details of the U.S. fiscal situation, it is a four-alarm fire. It is receipts were down year over year in the fiscal first quarter. And what we call true interest expense, which is just gross interest plus the entitlement, interest-like entitlements, just the pay-as-you-go portion, interest plus entitlements was 109% of receipts, which are falling. And those entitlements are growing at a multiple of nominal GDP. I mean, this is a classic foreign emerging market type debt problem. When we layer Veterans Affairs on top of that, it's 117% of receipts. And that's growing 10% because of all these wars over the last 20 years. If we layer defense on top of that, just for illustration, that gets us to 137% of receipts. And so if we cut, as a federal government, 100% of everything else the U.S. government spends money on, except for entitlements, interest, Veterans Affairs, and defense, the United States would still have spending of 137% of receipts. We would still be running nearly a $2 trillion deficit. And so that's why I say they need to do something now where it is a big bump up in nominal GDP growth. We can't just do 4% inflation on a 3% coupon. We need 12% inflation with a 3% coupon, something very big. And of course, that has different implications, but that's why I say there's got to be something. I think the other way you do that very fast is via this gold revaluation. You buy down debt, or you don't even necessarily need to buy down debt with it. At, $4,000 an ounce, that puts, if I recall my math correctly, it's $1 trillion or $1.2 trillion. If you revalue that at market, the U.S. official gold, that's $1 trillion, $1.2 trillion that Bessent doesn't need to issue. He can just spend that for the next year, year and a half. And so that gives him the flexibility. It buys him time as they try to do tariffs, as they try to do DOGE, some of these other restructuring-like items in terms of the capital flows in and out of this country and the government spending in this country, where they can do that without risking blowing up the treasury market like they did in the third quarter of 23 and the first quarter of 23 and the third quarter of 2022. So I think we are at a point, the fiscal situation is at a point where there's going to have to be a more dramatic out of the present Overton window of accepted policy to be done to sort of keep the wheels on the cart.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's a lot to digest. Your thoughts, Ira, in terms of, like, do you see a bold initiative, YCC, gold revaluation, Plaza Accord 2? Your thoughts, Ira?
Well, I mean, there's, as usual with Luke, there's so much to chew on, but the debt But let's get to the debt, because, you know, I've been on financial repression for probably 8 or 9 years already. And what attracted me when you guys was financial repression and the work of Carmen Reinhart before she wrote the book with Rogoff was about how to, you know, when the United States had engaged in financial repression right after World War II, because it's always wars that generate this, right? I have, Luke, I don't know whether you've ever read this, but I've been rereading this book. Get this book, A Tract on Monetary Reform by Keynes.
Okay.
By Keynes. And I'm pushing it because it's not a long book. It was written in October 1923, a very difficult period in financial history. And he is so prescient about what we're facing and where we're going here. And that's where we're at here. We are in the middle because of the debt situation. And you can't get, as Luke talks about, you can't keep sweeping it under the rug. As Keynes talks about in the second chapter, he brings this up, and he mentions four things that you can deal with the debt situation. Repudiation, but repudiation for the world's reserve currency, as we're reminded every day by all the dollar bulls. Oh, it's the, that has, that's a sideshow. Is, you know, that's the exorbitant privilege, if we can get back to Giscard d'Estaing. But then he talks about devaluation, depreciation, and the fourth or third rail that we'll call it is a capital levy. And a capital levy. Oh, yeah. Did you see Luke's face? Well, that was, I don't see Keynes's face, but that's what Keynes says. Because a capital levy is a road that you don't want to cross, especially in a democracy. That's, you know, you can do it in an autocracy. I'm sorry, Elon, I didn't mean that for you, but you can do that in an autocracy. But a capital levy would be the one step beyond. And Luke's face said it all. So are we going to any of those steps? Not as of yet. Not as of yet. But this debt situation is growing. And I'm not being Cassandra here. I'm not. This is a reality. And just because you're not paying attention to it, a lot of other people in the world are paying attention to it. And it has driven a lot. And don't forget, we have 6.3 trillion of it sitting on the Fed balance sheet. So they've already broken the market signaling. So don't look for the market to necessarily signal that. Although it's interesting that Bessent, by citing the 10-year, is trying to reorientate us towards a market response. And right now he's gotten, I'm not going to say lucky, but fortunate, because the market is giving him his due for the moment. And I think that's the point that Luke makes. But you better damn well do something with this. Now, remember the four things that Keynes talks about. So if you go depreciation or devaluation, as the world's reserve currency, as James Baker showed us in 1985, you can get away with it for a while. You know, people, you know, Larry Kudlow was talking about, well, if the dollar goes down, inflation goes up. Not so quick with the world's reserve currency, because you're still pricing everything in dollars. I don't have to go take my weaker currency and go purchase other currencies to buy what I'm importing. It's a huge difference. And that does buy them some time. But time, this is not an economics, this is not academic economics. This is not where you can play out a linear time and go, oh, I got, you know, in time I'll be right. You know, the great counterfactual, with time I'll be proven right. You're running out of time. That debt clock, and I hate to, because I hate looking at that debt clock that used to show in Times Square, but we're, and now it's about how do you deal with this? And you know what? With the dollar this high, U.S. debt is not an attractive asset, because you run the risk of a depreciating dollar by any metric. Because why? You're running two huge deficits. You're running a current account deficit of gigantic proportions because you're the reserve currency, and you're running a standard deficit to GDP ratio that's unsustainable. Now, and the cure-all from Rogoff and Reinhart is, yeah, you know, we need some years of 4 to 6% inflation, we can really, then you'll grow, the nominal growth of the GDP will grow, and you'll pay off the debt as long as you don't keep incurring the ridiculous spending. That's what we did during COVID, and COVID was a convenient excuse for ridiculous spending. And Trump's, listen, I was opposed to Trump's 2017 tax because they tax cut because they didn't pay for themselves. Yeah, if you wanted to do that tax cut, you should have paid for it. But nobody ever pays for anything. Everything is a, you know, Milton Friedman's free lunch. So I'll stop. But because this leads us, what are going to be the policy? Because that's what we're interested in. Because it's going to be policy that gives us the opportunity for profitable investments.
Well, to your point, Ira, you know, you say it's things can change fast. We're on the clock. And I think the last 3 or 4 trading days is a perfect example. Last week, Bessent and came out and said, Trump and I are focused on the 10-year, and the market took the 10-year to 4.39, 4.4%. There were a lot of people saying, look, okay, see, he's calmed down the long end from where we were 3-4 months ago. 3-4 trading days, we're at 4.65 today. We had one bad inflation print and, you know, a little bit of some market, you know, strong dollar a couple days ago. Boom, we're at 4.65 within 3-4 trading days. We're another 3 or 4 bad trading days from to being at 4.8, 4.9%. And now you're into that. And I've heard this from multiple different traders. You get the 5% on the 10-year, people are going to shoot first and ask questions. And once they get to that moment, then you're going to get into that regime that we saw in 3Q22 and in 1Q23 and in 3Q23 of dollar up. I think gold will go up. And everything else is going to go down, and it will just keep going down until they have to do something, more dollar liquidity, reconstrain the dollar, what have you. But again, for an administration holding itself out as we're doing things differently and we have cuts we can make, et cetera, that's going to be a pretty big indictment of their policy. So just within 3 or 4 days, it speaks to the level of debt deficit, et cetera, to go from 4.39 to 4.65 on the 10-year that fast. We're on knife's edge, and you know, it ties back to the initial points you made, Ira, about, look, this isn't the time to be running into the minefield. This is, you know, stay low over your skis and let's see what happens, because we could be at 4.8, 4.9 in a hurry on the 10-year, and then stuff's gonna, you're gonna start seeing where those mines are, and you don't want to be out there in those fields when those things start going off.
That's a great point.
And just coming back to Ira's question on the policy. We see that China and Japan are either at the government level or at the corporate level, encouraging corporations to sell U.S. Treasury bonds and repatriate those funds back to their home countries for helping industry development. So the big question is getting a bid on the U.S. Treasury bonds. Do you think that the U.S. administration now promoting the Bitcoin and the whole Tether U.S. dollar stablecoin plan will work to address U.S. debt? Is it scalable enough? So the idea here, just for everybody, is buying Tether U.S. dollar stablecoins necessitates purchase of U.S. Treasury bonds for collateral. And so that this could be happening globally, right? Somebody getting into stablecoins or into maybe the precursor to buying Bitcoin could launch this. So just your thoughts on that, Luke.
Yeah, I think it is. I think the stablecoin T-bill vector is a potential part of kind of a all of the above, all hands on deck search for balance sheet onto which to put treasuries. And I think it could work. It was something I'd been vaguely aware of as of last summer. Paul Ryan wrote about it in the Wall Street Journal. And we saw the Treasury Borrowing Advisory Committee talk about digital assets as a source of balance sheet demand, particularly at the short end, which surprised me greatly. And we've seen the Trump administration obviously talk about it. I think it's going to be part of some sort of solution. I think that has a couple implications. The first is, to me, it's highly unlikely that the stable coin balance sheets will be loaded up with any kind of duration. In other words, it'll all be T-bills at the short end, which is fine. But again, it implies It's inflationary. All else equal, if you're financing big deficits at the short end, it's going to be more inflationary and good for asset markets, weaker for the dollar. The other point is that I think we need much bigger, essentially, market cap of Bitcoin. In other words, at Bitcoin's market cap today is roughly, call it $2 trillion, right? 100,000 times 20 million outstanding. At 4 trillion, at 6 trillion, with call it maybe by regulatory fiat, a 20% collateralization ratio. In other words, if Bitcoin market cap is 4 trillion and we need, you've got to have a stablecoin backing of 20%, which is all in T-bills. 4 trillion times 20%, we're talking about $800 billion in T-bills. That's real money, even in the numbers we're talking about. So I think it can be done. I think it's a function on some level of Bitcoin market cap. I think it's, I have to tip my cap to the people that are kind of laying some of these thoughts out within the administration, the policymakers, because it's a massive dollar devaluation without calling it a dollar devaluation, right? It's not a dollar devaluation. It's a Bitcoin bubble. And, it rolls off the tongue a lot nicer than, we're going to devalue the dollar by 50% versus Bitcoin. It's and back it with T-bills and because of the deficit. So it's, it checks boxes. I think it's going to be, I think it could very well be part of some sort of, all of the above sort of balance sheet financing by committee for the short end. And I think it's good for Bitcoin ultimately.
Great point. Your thoughts, Ira, on this?
Well, the Bitcoin angle, I have to think about, I've been so wrong on it for so long. I was a big believer in blockchain, but blockchain, I think, is going to be the backbone of the stable coin. If we really move to stable coin, because I can own all kinds of government. I can own a Chinese stable coin as long as it's backed by, but as long as I hold it in a secured element. So that would be blockchain. But I mean, Luke, when he talks about, first of all, on the T-bill end, Bessent caved last week, which kind of surprised me. He caved because him and what's his name, who is at Hudson Bay, who wrote that paper with...
Mirren, Stephen Mirren?
Yeah, Stephen Mirren. And I read the paper that he wrote with Doomy, not Faber, but... I always forget his name, that he wrote. But Bessent gave in really quick to that because they had mocked it and beat it up. And then, okay, we're going to continue along this. And then he did it in tow with, I'm concerned about the 10-year. But don't pay attention to Donald's discussing. He doesn't say it that way, but that's the underlying meaning. We're more concerned because that's a market-oriented. They, you know what? When you let the markets work, they'll tell you what they think of you. And I think I'll give Bessent that. So he did cave on that. And he said, well, we're going to go with that for a while. I thought Luke's comment about, 20% capitalization in regard to Bitcoin. Well, Bitcoin, if for those who know anything about the United States history, Franklin Delano Roosevelt did confiscate gold. Will Bitcoin be confiscated? Well, I can turn to Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution about who can coin money, and Bitcoin then may give me a problem. But of course, it's held in ways that can't get, but there are ways to deal with that. So that always makes me a little bit nervous, but I've been dead wrong. I'll be the first one to say I've been totally dead wrong on it. But Luke brings up the capitalization element, and I find that interesting. So we do a 20% capitalization. Let's take gold, which you're revaluing, which by the Keynesians, the neo-Keynesians always said, well, gold, they quote Keynes as a barbarous relic, but it's also a great store of value. And in times of when you're doubting the credibility of the central bank that you live in or the government that you live in, gold becomes a very good store of value. And I think that gives us its utility. So here's what I would say to those and Bessent who wants to monetize the gold, and I know there's others out there, his name, who I won't mention, who are talking about it. But if you did that, then you should do what Luke talks about, a 20% capitalization, and write gold-backed bonds. United States gold-backed bonds. It's not one-to-one, but the hell if I wouldn't buy a bond backed by 20% gold and pay 1.5% less for it. Because I have downside risk, but I have upside risk and I have some protection. And I know it's US backed and it's a US backed. And so if I'm getting some interest, now all of a sudden I call this gold in motion. Put it in motion. It's not my idea. You know, the European Central, actually Brussels, who thinks of nothing good, wrote a paper about this in 2012 when they were struggling about what they were going to do with the Greek debt, with the Irish debt, with the Spanish debt. And somebody brought up the point that Europe has more gold than the United States, which they do as a combined entity, if it was under one roof, and they could have monetized it. They didn't talk about what Luke talks about, the 20% capitalization, to really give it some activity, but in order to make European bonds somewhat palatable. And I'm going to end because this discussion about gold is really interesting. And by the way, since we've come on, gold, which was $40 lower, has turned higher on the day. So silver, you know, so I'm just, I have my eyes on the screen. But there is a famous interchange, and I sent it to you, Richard, Luke, I don't know if you know, in 1974, between Henry Kissinger and Thomas Enders, who was an undersecretary of state. And the meeting was about, you can get it, it's part of the public record. And the meeting takes place and they're discussing because Europe wants to elevate gold. This is 1974. Bretton Woods has been sliced and diced. The United States is no longer allowing you to convert your dollars into gold, but Europe wants to elevate gold to cut some of the strength out of the United States. And Enders and Kissinger are figuring out how to prevent that from happening. It's a very interesting discussion. So if the United States goes about this, and I pose this as a question, if the United States revalues their gold, which it doesn't matter. You know, people are so bulled up on this, but gold's already at 2,900. So if I say today it's 2,900, it only means what, as we talk about, what kind of liquidity I can create. And, you know, it's not taxing somebody. It's just, okay, I have this on my book. It's a building that's $100 on my books, but it's really worth $1 million. Okay, so now I have a lot more liquidity to play with. But if they do that, that brings in a whole lot of stuff. But it also means, and I brought up the Enders Kissinger, it's the end of Pax Americana. Because all these other central banks and governments who are sitting on a lot of gold have now a lot more. Once you make that a credible source, it becomes elevated and you are diminished. It's okay to do it. I mean, I think one of the great things about Vicente, he's going to be very creative. Again, I don't know that he'll be successful, but he's going to be creative. So,
your thoughts on that, Luke, for the question?
Yeah, no, I think it's going to be brought forward or be used in some way. It's going to be put in motion, as Ira said, is simply because he's right that it is effectively a declaration of the end of, or admission of the end of it. But it's kind of like one of these football games where, like, it's already over in the third quarter, right? Like, it was like the Super Bowl, right? You're watching the Eagles and they're repeatedly sacking Patrick Mahomes over and over. And they're not blitzing. There's four guys on six protectors and they can't pass protect. Like, you, if you watch any football, you go, boy, if this keeps up, this game's already over. It's just a question of what's the final score going to be and sort of, you know, do the Eagles give it away? If they do something dumb, what have you. Same kind of thing where the writing's been on the wall for 10 years. The game, as soon as global central banks, as soon as the Chinese in particular, said in 2013, at the end of 2013, the Chinese said it's no longer in China's interest to grow FX reserves. That's it. That's the equivalent global monetary system of, wow, the Eagles are just sacking Mahomes over and over with four guys, with six guys in pass protection. Because that ultimately leads, because China is the system's creditor, by far and away the biggest trade creditor, that leads global central bank reserves to stop growing. And in third quarter 2014, global central bank reserves stopped growing. They haven't grown on net since, which means central banks haven't bought on net any treasuries since. And in the meantime, you have what is the, to mix my metaphors, the central bank version of the famous Lucy skit with the chocolates, right? With the chocolates, the debt just keeps coming faster and faster. And, you know, Lucy and her friend, it's not Desi in that case. I can't think of who it is, but
Ethel.
Ethel, yes, Ethel. Lucy and Ethel are the, you know, the basically the rest of the global private sector trying to figure out what to do with these chocolates, with these treasuries. And they're putting them in their mouths and in their hats and in their shirts and in their coats. And that's basically what we saw transpire from 2014 on, where we had HQLA regulations for banks, and then the money market funds were regulated into buying bills and turn them into government money market funds. And the Fed had to step in a couple different times. And then we had the repo rate spike at the front end. Then we had COVID, we had QE, we had all these different things. And you can see all these symptoms. But my point is that this admission of a revaluation of gold, of sort of the end of Pax Americana as it existed for a roughly 50-year span of time, is really kind of the denouement to what is already a game that's already been decided. We can see what central banks have been doing. We can see what arguably parts of the United States government has been doing since 2022 in particular. When we sanctioned Russian FX reserves, it strains credulity that some branch of the U.S. government didn't know that that was going to send a warning to the entire global central banking community that, hey, we'll take your paper. These aren't safe if you don't play by our rules. And we've seen every year since, central banks have bought over 1,000 tons of gold a year in reserves, not buying treasuries. And so I think ultimately we're going to see these things that have been in motion for the past 10, 11 years are going to drive. They're going to be sort of the icing on the cake is going to be this sort of admission. Listen, this is over. We're revaluing gold. It's going to create a deposit for us. And it's going to effectively be something, I think, that's the kickoff to the full restructuring of the economy, which is of the global monetary system, which is going back to settling in a neutral reserve asset. Because if geopolitically we want to separate from China, as in my opinion clearly seems to be the case, the arrangement where we run deficits, they make things for us, and then they recycle those deficits into the NASDAQ, which is effectively what they've done, that makes no sense. We have, and you know, it's interesting, Ira, you bring up the 74 Enders and Kissinger comment. There's another one from 73, which is, I think it was Weintraub in a memo to Volcker and Kissinger.
Weinberg. Casper Weinberg, yeah, yes. Go ahead.
Please. And so it talked about the European community then wanting to revalue gold to essentially recycle energy deficits, right? The price of oil had gone up a bunch, and so they needed a means to sort of recycle. And this brings up this memo brings up two interesting points that I think are very relevant today, which are that first, it highlights that if they settle in gold at a market price, at a much higher price, it gets rid of the interest burden for the energy importers, right? They don't have to issue debt and have future interest burdens. It removes the conflict of Arab ownership of European and American industry, which is an issue now again with Chinese ownership of American assets and industry. And it with absolute control over their reserves from seizure and provides some form of inflation protection. So it's fascinating to me, this, you know, there's nothing new under the sun, right? History is rhyming, repeating, where we once again have a period of time where we have a foreign creditor that we need to settle with, that we're running imbalances with, that we can't afford or don't want to pay more interest, that national control and inflation of reserve assets and inflation of those reserve assets are a serious issue. And once again, we find gold in that conversation vis-a-vis Bessent, et cetera. So I think we're moving in that direction. Bessent is far too savvy and experienced to have sat next to Trump in the Oval Office and said what he said about monetizing the U.S. government balance sheet for the American people. There's no way that comment happens unless it is specifically designed to signal something And it there's no way it happens, especially given Trump, that there's no way Bessent was freelancing without Trump's blessing, because that's just not how Trump doesn't like to be trumped.
Very good point. Right. I mean, if I may, Rich, I mean, this is where we lie. And with it comes a whole lot of stuff, as you point out, because, you know, everybody thinks that, you know, oil prices went up in 1973 because for the Yom Kippur War nonsense, as you talk about, Weinberger knew it, because the OPEC producers, mostly at that time, the Arab, because the Latin American producers, it was predominantly the Mideastern producers. They were tired of receiving depreciated currency for their energy. And they were looking for a way to change the entire structure, which they were very capable of doing. And then, of course, they got what came after that, which is huge growth, especially as the underdeveloped world started growing and energy demand. And then it was, of course, you had to recycle all that currency, right? And who, just so you know, this is kind of interesting, because who did you recycle it to? The worst creditors of all, because they were the energy importers who were merely spinning their wheels, borrowing more money to pay for more energy, to borrow more money to pay for more energy. And who was lending to them? U.S. banks. And then we get the great problems that, you know, came about when those loans couldn't be repaid to the banks who were the recipients of Kuwaiti, Saudi, Iraqi, Iran. That's where they were depositing it, and those deposits were being run. So who's the worst creditor right now? United States of America, because they're the ones who are soaking up and eating more of this recycled money than anybody else in the world.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
And the percentage of the reserve assets has already increased for gold as a neutral reserve asset from 3% to currently about 14%. So that's behind the dollar and the euro.
Mm. Yeah.
Just moving to how what makes sense in this environment, given all these trends, for investing assets, ideas for investing or trading. What are your thoughts, Luke?
I am very bullish on gold. I think gold is going back into the system as a neutral reserve asset out of necessity from both sides of the creditor debtor relationship, US China. And so ultimately it needs to be much bigger relative to global trade to serve that role. And so I think gold is I think moving secularly higher. It's one of my bigger positions. I also still have a heavy T-bill position. I've had it for probably 2 years. Even with interest rates coming down, I'm not trying to trade it. That's just my nod to I don't know what I don't know, the minefield, so to speak, in IRA's terms. And it gives me a yield while I wait, and it gives me the optionality and the liquidity. And then I have a good sized Bitcoin position. I've been there for a while. And for me, it is both a monetary debasement asset. There's some things unique to Bitcoin in terms of some of the applications that are developing around it that I think are positive for it over time. And then I continue to really like US, anything facing US electrical infrastructure. I continue to, one of my other bigger positions is a private equity investment in a US electrical infrastructure equipment business, and it's kind of a boring metal bender here in the Midwest. You know, longtime family owned, and it's generation agnostic, so they don't care if the electricity is being generated by nuke or coal or gas or whatever. They're making the equipment for it. And what they're hearing from their big multinational electrical supply chain corporation clients is demand is likely to be way higher than people think for the next 3 years. And as you guys know, you've been in the game a long time. There's no upside to these public companies saying, hey, I think demand could double or triple in the next 3 to 5 years. There's just, why put that on the board as a goal? And so they're sandbagging what they think demand's going to be. But you can take a look at some of the demand estimates for electricity from various AI and data center type applications alone, let alone if you start overlaying industrial reshoring in a much bigger way in the U.S. And you quickly come to the conclusion that the pretty decent growth numbers that they're looking for from some of these public related companies probably quite a bit too low. And so, you know, I think there are public proxies relative to the private one I'm involved with in terms of industrial and especially U.S. electrical infrastructure. So it's really, I think, a good chunk of my portfolio is in gold, T-bills, Bitcoin, and electrical infrastructure in the United States.
Any thoughts on oil and natural gas and also emerging markets?
It has been range bound, $70 to $90 over the last 2-3 years. And I think it's probably going to largely stay in that range. Maybe the range is 65, 85. But the reason for that range is much below $70, and U.S. shale has a hard time maintaining its production levels because of the break-even costs and the natural geology and decline rates in those basins inherent in shale oil production. And much above 85, and oil prices essentially push critical U.S. creditors into current account deficit positions, and they have to start selling treasuries effectively to finance current account deficits. Basically, they need to sell treasuries to buy oil. We've seen that a couple different times since 2022, and so I think ultimately my view is that we're likely to see oil stay in the, call it, 65, 85, 70, 90 range. And I think the release valve will continue to be the gold to oil ratio. In other words, I think gold is almost an oil play now, where because we need to maintain the sanctity of the treasury market, because we need to maintain the production levels of U.S. shale, because we've been such a big portion of global supply growth over the last 10 years, oil's got to stay 70, 90, or else all hell breaks loose. And if that's the case, then I think you'll continue to see sort of this creeping revaluation of oil, gold relative to oil. We've gone from 8 barrels an ounce in, call it, 2008. It's right around 40 barrels an ounce as we do this call here. And I think it's over time. Again, this isn't immediate, but I think gold's going to a 100, 150, 200 barrels of ounce of oil. And I don't think oil's going down a whole lot from that 70 to 90 range, again, because of the geology. So I think it's going to be, I think 70 to 90 oil in a range is really good for producers. I think it's really good for oil services. And I think it's good for their multiples over time. I've been surprised that I don't know that they've benefited that much, but ultimately, historically, oil related shares have had low multiples because of the volatility of oil. Some of that dates back to the 70s, right? Of oil has been kind of the marginal dollar inflation kind of driver. But if we're in a new regime, as I think we are, in transitioning further toward it, where oil is going to stay 70, 90, then you probably can start to put a higher multiple over time on the earnings of these oil companies and oil service related companies. That's my opinion. So that's why I think I don't have a strong view on natural gas either way.
And emerging markets?
I think I like China, Chinese equities. I think ultimately, you know, I thought it was underappreciated. We've seen last week or 2 weeks ago, the U.S. came out and essentially strong-armed Panama into convincing the Panamanians to leave the Chinese Belt and Road, we'll say. And like, great, that's a win. I think we're a great power, and that's our right if we if we're going to enforce some version of the Monroe Doctrine, where listen, the Western Hemisphere, you know, no China in the Western Hemisphere, great. What I don't get the sense markets appreciate yet is by far and away the biggest Belt and Road hub in the Western Hemisphere is the NASDAQ. There have been trillions of Chinese capital recycled into the NASDAQ. And if we don't want Chinese capital in the Western Hemisphere, that's trillions of Chinese capital that's got to go out of the NASDAQ and go somewhere else. And I think somewhere else is A, gold, and I think B, Chinese equities. And so I think in within emerging markets, I think Chinese equities, they're, you know, they're off the lows. They've had a nice rally. But boy, they've been terrible for several years. And so there's probably more open field running. I don't recommend a huge position there simply because I there is still, I think, a real fat tail risk on the geopolitical side vis-a-vis China and the US, like we saw with Russia a couple years ago with Russian equities. And that's just not something having had a small tail position in RSX when that happened. I don't like, yeah, right. I don't like going to bed and waking up and having even a tail position down 60%. That's not what I like to do. So I think you as an individual investor can capture probably the lion's share of the sort of capital reallocation flows we're talking about of, okay, no Chinese capital in the Western Hemisphere means NASDAQ's got to get smaller. That capital's got to go somewhere. Yes, Chinese equities, but there's geopolitical risk there. In my opinion, you get a lot of that by owning gold without a lot of the geopolitical risk of Chinese equities. So I do think Chinese equities do well, but I, you know, it's I'm never going to let it get to be a big position for the, and you know, unless we're sort of, you know, we get to some sort of kumbaya moment in 3 to 5 years from now with the Chinese. And even then, we'll see.
Oh, great comments and observations. Your thoughts, Ira? And Ira was part of that Russia RSX.
Yes. And let me tell you, Luke, I didn't have a huge, and over the years, whether I made money, and I did because the dividends were great, but I wrote the SEC 3 letters because I wanted to know, in a non-bankruptcy, how did they dispose of those assets and who bought them? And don't send me 6 cents on the dollar. You know, I wrote to Van Eck too, because the SEC was worthless. And now this, as far as I'm concerned, this is where Gensler should have gotten involved, but that's a whole other issue. But you know what? Those are the risks you take when you invest around the world and you look for things. And I mean, that was totally blindsided only because there's a liquidation. Now I still own the stocks in the Moscow Energy Company, which also paid a good dividend. I didn't have a lot of money. Maybe I have $30,000, $40,000 invested. And I still have yet to hear, but that's a single company, not an ETF. So I want to see where has it, because the Moscow Energy company hasn't gone declared bankruptcy, but that's for another. We can commiserate on that.
No.
But I agree with you. There are places. I like the natural gas sector because I have a guy who I love to talk to, Mike Lees, who's very knowledgeable about it. And it has been great, but it's been okay. If you know, it got through the Biden year with no LNG, but LNG is going to be a big mainstay of the global situation for at least over the next 10 years. Oh, you know, where it goes, I can't tell you. And I like some of the foreign banks, believe it or not. I've talked about it ad nauseum. Probably last time we did I love Tokyo Mitsubishi only because they own 21, 22% of Morgan Stanley. So the combination thereof, if they let me sit on that board, I think I could motivate them and kick them, you know, because they should really be using each other's strength. I think UBS is still a great play because they went back to being a wealth manager rather than wanting to be Goldman Sachs. And I think Credit Suisse has slowed them down a little bit as they try to work through this. I'm still loving Commerzbank only because I think Commerzbank in Germany is a takeover by some U.S. Forget the Italians. The Germans just won't allow it. It's what a besmirchment on their historical character. But I mean, things like that in the U.S., I still love ag. And ag has had a great setback. So do your work and due diligence, because China still needs to eat. In fact, there was an article in the South China Morning Post the other day talking about the importance of food for China. Now, stupidly, I think when we throw tariffs on, and we hurt ourselves in 2018 when Navarro was busy running around with tariffs, because it hurt the American farmers, because the American farmers had made great inroads into China, where they'd been trying to make inroads since the end of World War II, because nobody's a bigger producer, and the U.S. had such huge surpluses, but they never did. And but they spent a lot of money, and then all of a sudden they had the legs cut out from under them, and it's now Brazil who's the biggest, and with a cheap real, it remains so, because the real is, again, there where a currency becomes an asset. And the inflation numbers, you know, even Mexico, I mean, you look at the real yields on some of the emerging markets, which is a different spot in the world, which is why the dollar is too high, because they have to raise rates and keep real rates far higher in a strong dollar environment. And it's not that the dollar, going back to that, is strong on its underlying fundamentals. The only thing it has going for it right now is higher interest rates. And you, I think you've been around long enough, that's a false signal of strength, because that will erode. All of a sudden, if inflation jumps to 6%, you're not raising your interest rates, that 5% is now deemed a negative. We saw what happened when the dollar ran real negative yields. The dollar was down at, you know, on the dollar index, 90, 88, you know. So yes, I understand where we're at. A lot of other things I agree with. You talk about gold. Me, I look at platinum. Not that I've been bullish gold, because gold goes up and it ought not to be going up in the classic world in which we live in, because real yields in the U.S. are too high. Around the rest of the world, we can discuss that. But I look at some of the alternatives, because platinum, if and it's a big if you deem platinum to be a repository of wealth, you know, of maintaining your wealth during times of uncertainty, then it's way too cheap. If it's only an industrial use for catalytic converters and other things in the high tech world, then it's probably appropriately priced, especially to gold. But if you deem it as a store of value, it's phenomenally cheap. And I'm wondering why some of these other central banks haven't been glomming onto platinum, because China used to make those beautiful platinum pandas. I haven't seen them in a long time. And if I saw them today, I would probably doubt their authenticity anyway, with all the, so there are all kinds. And I love your build out on the grid, basically. So it puts you in copper is starting to perform again. It hasn't, especially as the EV world slowed down, copper seemed to slow down, but now all of a sudden it's back in the mix. So I applaud you for that. And where it all goes, I don't know. But I'm looking for real assets right now. I'm not, this is not the time for me to go out on the realm of wanton speculation. I'm looking for things. That's why I like ag and I like bank. You know, again, it's what your risk tolerance is and where you're getting into these. But there are global banks that I like. The American, I don't own one American bank right now. It's, you know, to my detriment, but they were a good investment to me. They're just, they run way ahead of the crowd and way ahead of the pack, which is why I look for others. Of course, you can get blindsided, but you can get blindsided by Silicon Valley and more importantly, First Republic. Because if you don't respect, and I say this over and over, if you don't respect what the market did to First Republic, a darling of the investment of people investing in banks, that it went from 160 to zero, faster than a Tesla goes from zero to 160.
Well, great. Just your final thoughts, Luke, and how can our listeners, viewers learn more about your work?
Sure. Yeah, I just think it's like Ira said, it's a tricky time. And I think, you know, especially for me, next 2-3 months, I'm kind of steady as I go and watching for, you know, another card to get turned and see what occurs. So in terms of where people can find me, fftt-llc.com for more information about our different institutional and mass market research products.
Great. Thank you, Luke and Ira.
Well, you find me here, and I love doing these discussions, and Luke's work is unbelievably good. It's not for the faint of heart. Again, pour yourself a good drink. Okay. Sit down in your chair on the weekend and take a read, because it's not a once over, but he takes you inside his brain, and that's worth, you know, because he's letting you see what he thinks. So, you know, and the fact that we get to do these and discuss, to me, these are real time ideas, and real, and again, it's all for investable outcomes, you know, and I just have had this discussion this morning. With all this other crap that goes on, I'm going to quote what a famous person I know, Abraham Tversky, said: "You don't let people live rent-free in your brain. And if you occupy yourself with this nonsense, you're letting people live rent-free in your brain. Get on with what you do, what you have to do, and then move it. But don't consume yourself with it. And that's why this is an investment minefield right now, because people are consumed with it. And yes, do I pay attention to Scott Bessent? I do, because to me, that's where it's going to emanate from. And if it doesn't, he's not going to be there long. And if you want to see a negative signal to the bond market, if Scott Bessent left quickly, I would be putting on steepeners till I couldn't see anymore, because the whole thing is going to get crushed.
Great. Yes. Awesome insights, discussion points, observations. Thank you so much, Luke and Ira.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's great. Really appreciate it.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.